You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 464 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carzino.
And we're coming to you as usual in separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the still, believe it or not, even after the losing streak, snap Tuesday night.
How dare you? Believe it or not.
AL West leading Seattle Mariners.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. I liked what you said hello at the beginning. Hello.
You know, you had to mix it up a little when you get 464 episodes plus emergency pods deep.
Wow. We've really recorded a lot of these fuckers.
Do you want to just go Mariners off the top here, semi-emergency pod style? This wasn't quite the 2022 classic between these two teams.
Let's do it normal. I mean, we get there so fast.
Okay. Well, we don't get there as fast this week because we have a topic that we don't usually have on the rundown.
Hello.
A little NBA discussion.
There we go.
Some NBA action, lots of NBA action. So
yes, speaking of which, I don't want to talk about it.
Well, I got to tell you, when not to step on the takes and the similarity to the 2022 Mariners-Yankees game, but when Matt Brash was pitching to Aaron Judge at the same time that Oklahoma City, that Jokic was hitting an incredible off-balance three-pointer to tie the game with a minute and a half left.
It was a great moment.
Never has
maybe
my attention.
A little bit of help from Jokic. Michael Porter Jr. Good God.
Well, he's injured. It's not Porter's fault.
Maybe instead of doing your own independent research, maybe you should spend a little bit more time practicing threes, my guy.
He shot threes very well before he suffered a serious shoulder injury that if the Nuggets had depth, they would just simply not play him down the stretch. But alas, that is not an option. I don't know. I'm definitely not writing Denver out of this series.
Okay.
They're going home for game six. It's a two-day break before game seven, which would be crucial given that the Nuggets are just running on fumes right now. And I mean, that's what happened because they had to keep Jokic in at the start of the fourth. That's why, and everybody else in, that's why they ran out of gas down the stretch.
First off, Jokic did not run out of gas. He does not run out of gas.
He did run out of gas, it seemed like, in game four. But no, he certainly was not the issue.
Does also Minnesota, I mean, if they close it out tonight as you're listening to this, they're going to have quite a bit of rest, a little rest advantage there.
Well, it might be one day rest advantage, but if Nuggets Thunder with seven and the Wolves closed out in five, then yes, that would be a huge advantage for Minnesota.
Kind of had their number during the regular season.
A little bit, although I mean, the season series was tied, I believe. Anyways, we are not here to preview a Western Conference Finals that
I'm
is
all
still
the Knicks
two
anyway.
Wins away from being set.
I'm a Knicks fan somehow. The world is a strange place.
The thing I really never considered on the last day of the season was, I don't know whether the Pacers actually won or lost on the last day of the season, but should the Pacers have won to assure that they could have gotten home court advantage over Denver in a possible NBA Finals match?
There we go.
Who knew? Who knew that was a concern? Again, not what we're here to discuss today. We start out with some serious news from Montlake. Our thoughts are with UW soccer goalkeeper Mia Hammett, who was diagnosed last month with stage 4 SMARCB1 deficient kidney cancer, an aggressive form that typically affects individuals with sickle cell trait. Hammett started 15 games as a redshirt junior, was named to the Big Ten All-Tournament team before experiencing respiratory issues after the season, started chemotherapy, has another round coming up soon. And certainly, you know, again, our thoughts are with her, all of UW Nation, supporting Mia right now in this battle. All right, on happier news from UW Athletics, a toast to Alexis DeBoer, named Big Ten Freshman of the Year, was also chosen All Big Ten after hitting .369 with 20 home runs and 54 RBI. The second Husky ever to reach 20 home runs as a freshman and the first Conference Freshman of the Year for UW since 2016. So, you know, given the low expectations, the number of transfers after last season, the one thing that absolutely went right for UW softball this season is they've got the DeBoer at UW. You've been saying it all along.
Well, now it's really about keeping her at Montlake. At
Yes.
this point, I don't know what the college softball NIL situation is, but whatever bag there is to open up for UW softball, open up the bag for Alexis DeBoer.
100%. All right, lastly this week.
Ironically, we are very aware of how much money her family has.
It is a matter of public record.
So,
As a state
just
employee.
making it clear, she does not need it.
But still, good for players for getting it, whether they individually need it or not.
Better for players getting it than coaches getting it.
which would even things up within the DeBoer family, perhaps. As we record this, we do not yet have a toast, and you still have a chance to weigh in on the toast for next week's pod, because the Discord voting is open
You
for
have a chance to weigh in on the toast for next week's pod.
less than
Whoop, whoop.
48 hours for this year's PeltonCast MVP, and there is a front runner for this honor, and that front runner is on this podcast, and it is definitely not me.
Wow. I want everybody to vote with their heart for this one and really think back to the year that we've had together on the PeltonCast and all the work that has gone in to this podcast, all of the preparation that I do, the notes that I compile every single week for the podcast, all of the editing that I do after, all the posting of the podcast of those things, the extensive notes that I make for each
The
podcast
original
after.
research.
Yeah, the original research. I just want people to think back on all of those important things that I do for this podcast and not that I just show up each week and talk.
Oh, you do some work for the takes
There we
for
go.
sure. And let me tell you, the response to last week's takes was off the charts, I would
Thank
say.
you.
Never has there been so popular take.
Especially from myself.
Oh. No, your response is that is the chart. That's always where your response stays. You're still looking back at that Tommy La Stella no holes and being like, look, Rowdy Tellez turned it around. They just didn't give Tommy La Stella enough time. If he would have gotten the Donovan Solano treatment, who knows what might have happened?
That's a great point.
All
The
right.
Donovan Solano treatment.
Well, we'll get to those takes in a second. But as I said earlier, we do
We're
start.
inventing new types of treatment within Mariners baseball now. Because, look, granted, you and I have only been paying attention for like 4 years. So, well, more you than me, but I've been paying attention longer. But types of treatment that free agents can get on the Mariners, we have a very small amount of players to compare it to. It's like if it's not in the
I mean,
1990s.
it's not like there's Mariners have signed that many guys who have been hitting 130
That is
for
true.
a
We've got
full
like
month and a half.
we could do the Russell Davis treatment or we could do the Donovan Solano treatment. There is no in between.
I'm not even sure what the Russell Davis treatment would be.
I can't really think of like a random free agent signing from the 90s. Vince Coleman, like I don't that's basically
But
all we could
some
do.
are you saying the other end of the scale is someone who did well in a small sample?
No, I'm saying those are the eras that we can compare it
Oh, I
to
see
and
what you're saying.
nowhere in between.
I'm happy to talk Mark McLemore and Stan Javier in a way that I feel like you are not as willing to do. Because the 2000 team, as we've gone over as recently as last week, the 2000 team does hold a special place in my heart and not yours.
I mean, you could
Even
say
though
like,
Ichiro wasn't even on the team.
no, I was out. I was out. People think that I was out on the Mariners because of Ichiro, but I was kind of out before then. Ichiro just cemented it.
Is once Griffey walked out that door, so did you.
I truly don't even remember why. I honestly wish I knew.
I think you're overstating this. We like there was the Pedro game we went to
That was
early
the
on in
only
T-Mobile
game that I
Park.
like knew what was going on.
We went
And
to
I
the
think
final game of the season in one of those years, I remember,
Real
and I think
Ibanez, right? Didn't Real Ibanez hit a homer? We left.
I know we left early. That sounds right. That Raul Ibanez
But like
hit a
now it would
walk-off.
be unheard of to me to leave early from a close game.
Yes.
I don't, it's radically different. I am as big of a fan of the Mariners now as I was from like 1993 to 1998, and I do not think there is anything in that dead period.
There's some things.
Like I'm aware that Jeff Cirillo was a bad free agent signing, but other people could compare it to that. But for me, it's like you got Tommy La Stella.
Okay, this was in fact the last home game of the 1999 season where Raul Ibañez walked it off with his second home run of the game
Wow.
leading off.
I remember walking out and hearing the crowd cheer, but like I didn't feel a thing.
Leading off the inning against Mariners legend Shigetoshi Hasegawa.
Wow. One of the Angels?
Yeah.
On the Anaheim Angels?
It was actually his only home run of the game. I did misread that, but still a memorable performance. And yes, at that point they were in fact the Anaheim Angels still rocking the Angels in the outfield logo.
Do you remember this was right around my birthday? I want to say I'm pretty sure it was 2003. There was some game that the entire family had bought tickets for. I think it might have been a Yankees game. This is like a distant enough memory that I don't even really remember. And there was complicated driving plans. Does anybody else do this? Or are we the other people had to have, but are we the only people who drove a car down early, parked a car during the day, and then found other means of transportation? I don't even know how we got back down there, but I know it was the most complicated plan that could have possibly been devised. Do you remember this at all?
No, I mean, obviously I remember the general thing, more of a Kingdom
I
of Mirror
actually
memory
don't
for
even
me.
think I don't know if I even went to the game. I think I may have just chauffeured people. I'm
How
pretty
out you
sure.
were on the Mariners. You were like, I will drive to the stadium, but God
Around
forbid.
Memorial Day 2003, I can guarantee you that this happened. But you remember we used to do that a lot. Like people used
Oh
to
yeah.
go and park Cadillacs, various Cadillacs, and
Dodge
what was the,
Dynasties.
yeah, Dodge Dynasties down by the stadium early. I feel like other people must have done this, but I've never heard anybody else doing it. So I don't know. Maybe it's a Jan original. I don't know.
I don't think it's an original, but I definitely think it's New Heights. But anyways, that is not what we are here to discuss. Parking, or is reserving your spot early, near the I guess north of the Starbucks headquarters, circa the 1990s. Instead, we are going to discuss the latest comments from NBA Commissioner Adam Silver on expansion. He reiterated to SiriusXM NBA Radio Tuesday that his expectation is that expansion will be on the agenda at the NBA's Board of Governors meeting in July at the NBA Summer League in Las
Really?
Vegas, quote, to discuss with full ownership now for the 30 teams to get directly the existing owners' views on potential expansion and how we would begin furthering the study of all the implications. So he's alluded to this before that they would take this up at the summer owners' Board of Governors meetings, but this is kind of the most direct that he's been about it. And it's also fascinating in the context of the news that came about an hour later, which is that the is first reported by my ESPN colleague Shams Charania. The Portland Trail Blazers announced they are beginning the sale process is dictated by the terms of Paul Allen's estate. According to the statement, the process is, quote, estimated to continue into the 2025-26 season. And then the statement, notably, given the local ties in Vulcan Sports, statement concludes by saying, quote, this news does not affect the Seahawks or the estate's 25% interest in the Sounders, and neither is for sale.
It was very matter of fact.
Well,
It
we've
was.
seen this before. Because what I wanted to go back to before you react is in 2022, when Phil Knight and his
Ugh.
partner, real estate developer Alan Smolinski, made very public their offer for the Portland Trail Blazers. Jody Allen, as executive of the estate and the person who is functioning as governor of these teams, put out a statement that read in part, as we stated before, neither of the teams is for sale, and there are no sales discussions happening. A time will come when that changes, given Paul's plans to dedicate the vast majority of his wealth to philanthropy, including sidebar, the results of this sale. But estates of this size and complexity can take 10 to 20 years to wind down. There is no preordained timeline by which the teams must be sold. Until then, my focus and that of our teams is on winning. So, striking the same tone about the Seahawks, but now a change of plan with the Blazers.
So let me ask you why. What is it about? Because the directive is still there. It's not a directive just about the Blazers, right? From the Paul
Correct.
Allen estate. It is a directive overall for all of his assets, correct?
Yes, presumably the majority of which by now have been sold off. This has been a process that has been going on for many years, back to Paul Allen's death in 2018. So, it already the complexity can take 10 to 20 years to wind down. We're already getting close to the 10-year mark by this point, but
If I'm parsing this, am I parsing this correctly, which is Jody Allen just doesn't want to own the Blazers anymore. Jody Allen is fine selling the Blazers at this point. Jody Allen still wants to own the Seattle Seahawks. And the 25% share of the Sounders is a little different, but the controlling share of the Seahawks is the most important piece here. And is it a little bit of, yes, it's in Paul Allen's estate, but I'm also ready to move on from this team.
So I would say the sense that I've always gotten is that, well, Jody Allen has been in active presence at Blazers games throughout her time as governor running the estate, that it is not the same sort of the Blazers are not the same sort of passion for her that they were for Paul Allen, who, very eagerly purchased the Blazers and then somewhat reluctantly, it felt like, purchased the Seahawks to prevent them from moving in conjunction with the vote that funded Lumen Field, which we'll talk about in a second here. The sense I get is that Jody Allen is much more involved in Seahawks ownership than she is with the Blazers. Not again that she's not involved, but this is more of a passion for her. So it makes sense that especially if part of the way that you explain that you're continuing to manage the Seahawks is because of the fact that, well, I have to deal with the complicated sale of the Blazers, that one would go first.
Fair enough. Okay, so what does this mean, I guess, for the Blazers themselves, but also does it have any implication on expansion?
I mean, it might. I mean, obviously, we've seen in the past that the NBA has, used these sales that are ongoing as a reason to delay the expansion process. I think one of the differences between the sale of the Celtics and the sale here is that it was important for the NBA to establish a high valuation for the Celtics to justify to a degree the kind of expansion fee that they were going to ask for teams in presumably Seattle and Las Vegas, but two expansion teams. Portland is clearly not at the same level of market as those two cities would be. So you don't need to like establish this the value of expansion teams by waiting for the sale of the Blazers. So my hope would be that it would not be affect things. I obviously people are going to, and I saw friend of the pod Michael Sawyer giving Zach Whitman, who grew up a diehard Blazers fan, a hard time about this on Blue Sky. Like people are going to make jokes about the Blazers moving to Seattle. That is not going to happen. Like nobody wants that to happen. That's not a realistic scenario. I mean, I have no reason to think that the Blazers are going to go be anywhere else but Portland, where they've enjoyed tremendous fan support. And I think, Nike is a major partner of the league, likes having an NBA team in its backyard. Clearly Phil Knight does. He would like to own said team.
Is
We'll
he
see.
the favorite right now? Is he the most likely owner?
Clearly there was a degree of animosity related to Knight's attempts to purchase the team previously and then go public with them. And then, have stories out there about Allen's ownership and that sort of thing. Like, there's a lot of bad blood there.
Ooh, I just really hope it's a hedge fund manager. Fingers crossed.
Is the thing. People who like are like hoping for the Seahawks to get sold because they don't think that Jody Allen is a very good owner. It's like,
I just
what do you think the
really hope it's
alternative is
somebody who
here?
runs a suspect online loan company.
You know what I hope?
What?
It's John Stanton.
Yeah. We need that fate on everybody. No, that's a good fate now.
No, Trinitarius working magic
If
within
Phil
the
Knight
tight confines of that budget.
owns, this is a decree right now. I don't care if there are 12 Tumani Kamaras on the Blazers. I don't care if Brandon Roy unretires and is prime Brandon Roy and plays for the Blazers again. It does not matter to me. I am out on the Blazers forever, and they are public enemy number one at that point if Phil Knight is the owner of the Blazers.
Have you considered the possibility that Phil Knight is owner of the Blazers, that his attention might be diverted a bit from Oregon Athletics?
I'm not scared of Phil Knight. Thank you. We don't need his attention to be diverted from the team down south. Please, please keep funneling money into that team because every time we beat them, it'll feel that much better. I saw they have a five-star recruit the very next day. Dan Lanning's jumping into pools. The very next day, his dad's like, well, we're not closing recruitment. And it's just like, have fun. have fun playing this game right now. We've got OKGs. We've got the best college football coach in the country in Seattle, Washington. Don't you dare imply that I'm scared of Phil Knight or the team down south. They could spend every dollar on the face of the earth and still not win a national championship. So
it is an interesting time for the Blazers to be sold. This comes shortly after they moved to extend both Chauncey Billups and their general manager, Joe Cronin. So, you know, normally that's sort of the opposite of what we see before a team is sold. With the new owner kind of wanting the ability to put their stamp on the organization. They are currently working under a short-term lease, but working towards a long-term lease with the city of Portland at the Moda Center.
Who built the Moda Center? Was Paul Allen?
I mean, I don't know the level of what level of public funding there was, but it was spearheaded by Paul Allen in a very different way, certainly, than Key Arena.
But it's still a city property.
Well, it's gone back and forth several times. It recently was transferred by the Blazers as part of this short-term loan agreement back to the city. So
okay,
we could do a several-hour-long podcast just on the history of Moda Center ownership going back and forth and the various machinations around that. But you know I think it will be up to the new owner probably to strike the long-term lease. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I guess that could happen during the sale process. But there's no reason to think the team will be anywhere else. Portland has come to an agreement with the Blazers on jointly funding a number of upgrades to the arena leading up to the 2030 Women's Final Four there. You have the Portland WNBA team coming in now is a tenant of the Moda Center. So, again, there's just... You know, no reason to think that they're going anywhere, but certainly would be a positive sign, I think, for people in Portland if there was local ownership.
Okay. So the news is basically expansion is on the menu this summer.
I have to assume that Adam Silver was not caught off guard by Jody Allen's announcement.
No, I'm sure he wasn't.
It seems unlikely.
Luka Doncic trade, yes. Jody Allen's announcement, no.
Or was he? The lottery payback for the
fan.
Mavericks.
I will say, I've never been angrier at a draft lottery, to be honest.
I don't know. It was.
I don't really care. It's one of those things where you're just like, ugh.
But it's also really more West teams. Like all the good players need to go to the West again.
I mean, we don't have a horse in this race right now. You know what I mean?
Well, I've got some bad news for you about where the Sonics are going to eventually play.
Sure, but like,
it's not going to be the Eastern Conference.
I'm telling you right now, I'm not like, Will, I don't want a team if Cooper Flagg's in the West.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'd rather have Cooper Flagg on the Wizards or the Hornets.
We are not so privileged with a hypothetical expansion basketball team that we're worried about where other players are playing.
I'm just also saying this is someone who has to watch a lot of 4 p.m. Pacific time basketball. Give me something in the Southeast Division, please.
All right, anyway. I feel the exact opposite way. I love the late night games. I'm never going to watch 4 p.m. basketball.
We are not
the
same.
If he was in Charlotte, Cooper Flagg might as well be on fucking Mars.
Charlotte would have really come alive as a market with Cooper Flagg. Would have been nice to see, but alas.
I mean, it would have been kind of cool, but like for me, I would have never seen him. So when he's playing on the West Coast, those teams are always on TV.
Correct. So Bob Condotta reiterated and writing about this in the Seattle Times that the clause in the referendum of funding Lumen Field that would require 10% of Seahawks sale proceeds within a certain period of time to go to the state of Washington, we've talked about that in the past, reiterated that expires this month. So we will be past that for a potential Seahawks sale. But again, as we talked about at the open here, all indications are that Jody Allen enjoys running the Seattle Seahawks. And I don't think... that a sale was likely anytime soon. All right, with that, it is time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
I had a whole set of takes written about how I hate precocious children. They peak too soon. They're annoying. I wonder why I've hated them since I'm a kid. Present company included. Yada, yada, yada. And then, on a cold May night in Seattle, Washington, I ripped them up, tore them to pieces, and sent them into the sound because Brian Wu pitched a gem. I wrote new takes. The pennant is back on the menu, boys, I said. Brian Wu held the best offense in baseball to nothing as the Mariners blanked the Yankees and won a gritty 1-0 game. And then Dylan Moore sent a ball wide of Cal's glove, and I ripped them up again. It was a bleak outcome, the kind of game the Mariners have somehow found a way to lose. The evil empire, as Aaron Goldsmith said, had gained ground. But there were two force ghosts from the past in the building tonight, as well as some new recruits, Carlos Vargas and Casey Legomita, who has quickly become one of the Mariners' best pen arms, pitched borderline uneventful 10th and 11th innings. It was eerily quiet in the stadium during those innings. And then we used the force, Lug. That's for Legomita. Channeling.
Not sadly for Luke Rayleigh, unless he's one of the force ghosts at this point.
Channeling. Two of the greatest to ever use it with clutch ABs. J.P. Crawford dipping back into his own cannon, reminding us of his clutch hit to close out 23. And Luis Torrens. Now that's a name I've not heard in a long time. Clutch hit in 2022. This time it was J.P. again with the final blow to the core of the Death Star 2. The World Series is back on the menu again, boys, as Scott Servais, Luis Torrens, and Anakin Skywalker look on from the T-Mobile skies. What a night!
What is T-Mobile Park is not the rebel base on Yavin? Yeah, this is great.
I was talking about Endor here more than Yavin.
I suppose so, but that's been in the news lately with Andor.
I'm aware of that, but we were looking ahead of that. All I care about is Star Wars again now.
You listen to the rewatchables?
Oh, I didn't just listen. I consumed the rewatchables. We'll see if we have time.
No, we do not have time.
I just want to say
we'll talk Star Wars universe next week after we have completed Andor.
The thing is, and he has to be lauded because he hasn't gotten that much praise. George Lucas. The thing that I was thinking. Because, like, you watch, this is not Andor spoilers or anything like that. I've watched Andor up until the three episodes that dropped today. I watched all of Rogue One, and then I watched Star Wars: A New Hope, aka Star Wars. The amount of meat that George Lucas left on the bone from a movie like that, where it's just all of these little nuggets that could be filled in, he didn't even bother filling them in with the prequels. And how much there is for Andor. Like, Andor doesn't happen unless George Lucas writes this amazing script in 1977 that has all of these moments that they talk about. Because when you're watching it, like when I was watching it as a kid, or even 10 years ago, the amount that you're like digesting all of the things that they're saying, it's so much clearer now after watching Rogue One and Andor. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because there's stuff that it's kind of like washes by you. You know, like things that they say. And it's like, there's Darth Vader. You know what I mean? Like you kind of see the bigger things. But then after watching those, all of a sudden, like the dialogue and the things that like Grand Moff Tarkin is talking about and him, the conversations him and Vader are happening. It's like, oh, I understand this completely now. Because before it was all these open ends. So anyway, it was a very fun rewatch. I'm assuming you're going to do this after you watch the three episodes of Andor. You're going to watch Rogue One. And then watching A New Hope is kind of like, it completes the puzzle.
It does make sense. I watched I can't remember when exactly. I think it was the first 8 episodes in order before episode 9 came out. Which one is that? Rise of Skywalker or whatever?
No one cares.
No one cares enough to remember. Anyway, but I have not rewatched the original Star Wars since then, so I am curious to go back as well. Matt Brash, love having him back in our lives.
Oh, I'm in the bullpen. I'm also in a fortunate place. I watched the game on Friday while you were here. I didn't watch any of Saturday's game. I didn't watch any of Sunday's game, and I didn't watch any of Monday's game. I had stuff going on all three of these days, so I saw basically none of the losing. I just checked in, and then I was back in it on Tuesday, and I was like, great, the Mariners are the Mariners again.
In your mind, the Mariners are on a winning streak.
Yep.
The Toronto series over the weekend that you referenced, the first series loss for the Mariners since their opening road series at San Francisco, which likewise was also a sweep. So the Mariners have not lost many series this year. When they do, they usually don't win any games in them. So it all but guarantees going into Wednesday series finale against the Yankees that the Mariners have to win the rubber game here.
That's a lot of confidence from you.
I'm joking.
Okay. Who's starting on Wednesday? Is it Castillo?
That's a great question. It's not one I'm prepared to answer at the present time.
Okay. What about the injuries, though? Who's going to be starting games soon?
Well, it is in fact Luis Castillo, not the Luis Castillo that got traded.
I didn't think it was.
There was at least one aggregator, as got posted in the Discord, that got that Castillo wrong
I think that would have been
trade wrong.
against the rules
What do you mean?
for it to be the Luis Castillo who got traded.
Well, he could agree to it. George Kirby was touched up a
No, you
little
can't
bit.
just agree to start a game for another team.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. George Kirby was touched up a little bit in his second rehab start for the Rainiers, but extended a little bit deeper in terms of pitches. He's got one more rehab start in Tacoma scheduled Friday before a possible return to the Mariners rotation, which if he continued on that schedule where he's been pitching every 6 days would come on Thursday the 22nd. So,
That's the
we're
take that I
still
should have done. George Kirby washed. If he can't get outs in AAA, how is he gonna get Aaron Judge out? That's if we were really doing takes.
You need the name of some guy named Aaron in AAA who had gotten
Yeah,
a hit off of him,
there we
and
go.
then say, "How's he going to get Aaron Judge off?" That's the play. So we're looking at potentially 9 days away from his return, which is good because in addition, the six aces, or was it seven aces at one
I
point?
think we went to seven. No, we reduced it back down to six.
We did. I think we might have to go back
Last.
10 to 5.
Oh, no.
Although I will say sending Emerson Hancock back out there a third time against the Yankees hitters in the top of that order, like it's one thing to send him out there. It was only the fifth inning, hadn't thrown very many pitches. But as I noted in the Discord, you have to have someone warming just in case. Like you know that things can get out of hand in a hurry, and they sure did.
I probably have like too fast of a mental hook for players, if that makes sense. But like you have to have the feeling like there's just a gut feeling where it's like this isn't going to go well.
Right. When you look out there and you see Emerson Hancock on one side and Aaron Judge on the other, you're just like, it is what it is.
I get it, but like the things that Dan is thinking about are not the things that I'm thinking about. He's trying to manage the bullpen, and he knows
Correct.
that the bullpen arms, you know, like he's looking at it from the perspective of, I look, this might not go well, but I need to try to get another inning from Emerson Hancock because the amount of bullpen arms, and you know, like obviously the bullpen arms were used up quite a bit as well today. Obviously, they have an off day on Thursday, but they had to go through a lot of them in the extra innings game.
Yes, Wednesday's game will be interesting from that standpoint. But Logan Gilbert also progressing in his work back from being shut down with a forearm strain through his first bullpen since then on Tuesday, came out of it feeling well. So, encouraging signs there, obviously. It's going to be a while for him. We saw, George Kirby was shut down in March in spring training, and we're just now talking about getting him into the rotation again at the end of May. So, that gives you an idea of the timetable, but certainly, I think easier for the Mariners to handle one of those two being out than both of them. All right, the last Mariners note I have.
The Yankees are starting a player tomorrow named Will Warren, and I would describe him as a guy, just a guy.
Guy we're eventually going to remember. We discussed the Mariners teriyaki before the season, but the Mariners now are doing a teriyaki night on May 27th. The description, we're partnering with renowned chef Kenji Lopez Alt for our first ever teriyaki night. As part of this year's new menu offerings, we've introduced the Turn 2 Chicken Teriyaki Bowl in collaboration with Kenji, giving fans the chance to enjoy one of Seattle's signature dishes at the ballpark. To celebrate our special offer on Tuesday, May 27th, includes a bowl of our new signature chicken teriyaki and a Mariners Teriyaki Night t-shirt. So if you've ever wanted to combine two of Seattle's most iconic things, the Mariners and teriyaki, this is for you. You remain skeptical.
I'm a little skeptical.
Kenji mentioned that he has had teriyaki from 37 different restaurants so far, which is about double. I went and looked it up. We went to 19 as part of our search for Seattle's best. Now, Kenji, admittedly, I think is going a little farther down the scale than we are,
I
but
gotta say, I'm more impressed with us that we got to 19 different teriyaki places.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what our record was for most locations visited in a single search. I know what our record is for longest time taken in a single search.
Infinite?
But the cookie search is progressing. Possibly as soon as next week could be back on the menu.
Oh, I'm back. I'm about it. I'm gonna see how much the teriyaki night tickets are.
I mean, I assume they're pretty standard priced tickets.
Would you like to
Usually,
guess?
27 or 55.
58.96.
That's the only price point?
Yes. I mean,
Okay.
it includes a t-shirt. I get it. It includes the teriyaki. I'm skeptical about things that still should be cheap just because it's the ballpark. The thing that we concluded about teriyaki is that A, all teriyaki is great. B, your neighborhood teriyaki is the best.
But
C, you
admittedly,
don't need it at a baseball game.
when you're in teriyaki, when you're in T-Mobile Park is your neighborhood teriyaki. If you think about it that way.
I'm a little skeptical about it, about the tie-in. I think fame is the worst thing that can happen to a chef. That's what I'll say.
I mean, Kitchy's been famous for a long period of time.
Fame is maybe the worst thing that can happen to anybody,
Quite
present
possibly.
company included.
Which of us is famous? Is it you for the tiny desk?
I was talking about myself for the possible Belt and Cast MVP.
Oh, okay. There we go. Heavy,
Have you
heavy.
talked draft coverage yet this year?
For the NBA draft?
Yeah, yes.
No.
The one that you would be part of? When do you start talking about that?
I don't know. We'll see.
Like a week beforehand? Y'all don't really plan that super far out.
Sometimes more than others. Shall we get into the roundup?
Sure.
Let's start with the Kraken. Frank Saravalli of Daily Faceoff reported on the DFO Rundown podcast that the Kraken have offered their coaching job to former Canucks coach Rick Tocchet, who could have his pick of several open jobs after completing his contract in Vancouver. So we'll stay tuned on that one. Seattle Sounders, wild match Saturday in Houston. I was following this as we were at fourth Talkin' Taco Time co-host
His
because it's
fourth.
not. It's
We've
not.
assigned him as number four.
No, I'm just saying. Usually we say third Pelton brother, but it's just your talking Taco Time co-host, Chris Smith, at his birthday party.
I think Randy is technically the fourth Talkin' Taco Time cause.
If we're doing it in order of seniority, then I suppose so. If you're doing it in importance to the podcast, we are definitely three and four in
Oh,
some
yeah,
order.
I'm definitely fourth.
A wild match Saturday in Houston.
They don't really like Taco Time.
Danny Musovski opened the scoring and extended his own goal streak to five in the 22nd minute, only for the Dynamo to equalize 10 minutes later. In the 38th minute, Houston was called for a straight red for a denial of a goal scoring opportunity. Albert Rushnak missed the ensuing penalty, but the Sounders utilized the man advantage and Rushnak atoned to score twice after halftime. Sounders matching their precisely three XG in this one. It was the first start for the Ryan Kent, who assisted the second Rushnak goal, continues to play an important role. Sounders surging up the West standings. They are up to fifth and tied for the fourth best goal differential in the conference at plus six. They leapfrogged LAFC ahead of their matchup on Wednesday. LAFC off to a slow start with a plus one goal differential. On Saturday, they complete this stretch of three game matches in 8 days with a derby at Portland. Timbers come in third in the West, 2 points ahead of the Sounders, but also have a weaker goal differential at plus three. And then a little bit of additional Sounders news. They signed Osaze De Rosario to a first team contract. Osaze De Rosario, I should say. The 23-year-old had been on fire for the Tacoma Defiance with 10 goals in 8 matches this season, including one on Tuesday, as the Defiance gave the Portland Timbers a scare before losing in the U.S. Open Cup last week. Previously played for York United of the Canadian Premier League. His dad, Dwayne, was an MLS MVP, a four-time MLS Cup champion, and remains among the top 10 scorers in MLS history. Sanders had a great note on social media. Dwayne De Rosario was on the field for Stephen Fry's MLS debut, and then Fry was on the field for Osaze De Rosario's MLS debut. So really full circle there. Reign FC also playing Houston on Sunday, took a 1-0 loss. Rookie Maggie Graham scored the game's only goal in the 57th minute for the Dash. Reign put just one shot on goal as teams combined for 9 total attempts in a drab performance. After the loss, Reign tied for 8th in the NWSL table with Racing Louisville ahead of their matchup Friday in Kentucky. Louisville has a -4 goal differential, has allowed nearly twice as many goals as the Reign, who are even Steven this season. All right, Seattle Storm. The season is here. Opening night Saturday, the Storm headed to Phoenix to take on the Mercury. Plenty to attend to before that. On Saturday, they traveled to LA to face the Sparks in a close scrimmage at UCLA. There was some video footage that was out there. It looked like Skylar Diggins had a terrific game in this one. We saw a lot of Alicia Clark and Gabby Williams playing together on the wing, a little bit different look than we saw in the Storm's lone technical preseason game because Gabby Williams did not play in that one. She was resting. Ezzie Magbegor also getting her first action. And then the other thing that really stood out, first off, from the highlights, Dominic Malunga looked terrific in
Oh
her first
yes.
WNBA competition against
Oh
an opponent
yes.
and was playing at times with Lee Yarou. So you had 6'6 and 6'7 out there.
Hello.
So one of my projects is to look up like what's the largest, the tallest front court in WNBA history that has logged meaningful minutes because I think that Lee and Malunga have a chance to break that this season. So the Malunga hype train is full steam ahead.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Some news related to that. Both Malunga and Gabby Williams announced on social media on Sunday that they are out of the French squad for Eurobasket, which is going to take place next month with the
Is
finals
that
and
to focus on the WNBA?
correct. So they will
Okay, good.
remain with the Storm all season. They probably would have missed somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 games had they, gone for the 2 weeks of training that the WNBA allows beforehand and then had France made it all the way to the final. So certainly a big deal for the
Is
Storm,
that
particularly with Katie Lou Samuelson's injury.
the Storm, I assume, wanted them there. Is it also
Yes.
the Storm can't offer extra money to stay, right? The salary is the same.
I have to double check this. I believe that players do not get paid for the time they're away from the team for those international competitions, but that I'm not 100% certain on.
Was there also a playing time issue? Was Dominic Malunga going to be getting minutes with that team? And it was kind of like, hey, you're going to play here in Seattle. You're young. You're going to play. You're going to be part of the rotation.
So Malunga didn't play a ton in the Olympics. She's a year older and more experienced now. The other thing is, like, frankly, had she decided to go, she would have benefited from some of the other players who aren't. It's not necessarily post players, but with Williams out, we also saw the announcement that Carla Leite of the Golden State Valkyries, who's with them as a rookie, is not going to play in this squad. Like, she's a guard, Williams is a wing, but the more players that are out, the more important Malunga could have been, particularly with her scoring potential.
What is Eurobasket the Euro for basketball?
Correct.
But it's they
But
do it the
it
year after the Olympics, not
they
every 2 years.
have no, they do it every 2 years. I mean, the Euro is every 4 years.
Oh, the Euros every 4 years, just on the off years from the World Cup.
Correct.
Yeah. So they do it every 2 years. Okay, fair enough.
Timing wise, I suppose it is more similar to the Gold Cup in soccer terms, where it's every other year and where there isn't the other major international competitions.
Can we not just figure this out though? Either not do it, A, or B,
I
because
don't think they're going to stop doing it.
the WNBA is it was made in an era when the WNBA wasn't as powerful as an entity as it is now. The
Correct.
WNBA is it. It is the final frontier of women's college or of women's basketball. Right? That is done. Signed, sealed, delivered. There's
So
not going to be competitors throughout the world that are playing at that level. The WNBA is now akin to the NBA as far as importance internationally in basketball,
don't
right?
know if I go that far. Because the best European squads can still rival WNBA teams, and sometimes in a handful of cases, including Gabby Williams, Fenerbahce teams, perhaps exceed them in terms of pure talent.
That's not what I'm saying, though. Caitlin Clark plays in the WNBA, and Caitlin Clark doesn't play in Europe.
Sure, but what I'm saying is for individuals, I still don't think they're quite to the point where it's like, I am not going to play in Europe during the WNBA offseason because I'm focusing solely on the WNBA. We may soon get to that point.
As the money goes up, I mean, the money is the factor.
The league's prioritization rule is something I talked to Nneka Nwumike, the president of the Players Association, about for the story that Michael Vopel and I did last week on the upcoming CBA negotiations. And Nneka basically made the case that, she would like players to prioritize the WNBA by their choice because of the fact that the WNBA is paying so well. And I think this is these players who are opting out of Eurobasket, they're not alone. Satu Sabally, who represents Germany, is another example. Or I think an example of the WNBA be taking a higher precedent than it has in the past. And that will only increase. And it's possible that at some point that could force the Eurobasket to move to outside the WNBA window.
It's coming. It is coming.
Is obviously men's Eurobasket is, but just that's always been the case
It's
because
over, Eurobasket. The hippies lost.
the men's seasons are concurrent for Europe and the NBA.
And the money is increasing for the WNBA very quickly.
Well, the thing I cited in that story is that I was told by one person with a team that they've heard that salaries could the Supermax could reach a million in the next CBA, which would be
I'm
basically
kind of
four
surprised that they
times what it
won.
is now.
Okay. But also sponsorship money is increasing, I would assume, also extraordinarily quickly.
Without question. Less public that, but that has happened already in a way that the WNBA salaries will become commensurate in much more meaningfully next year.
Okay, get through these next 2 points, and I want to ask some questions about the storm season.
Storm also set their final roster. Zaya Cook won the 11th spot on the roster. They waived recent third-round picks Mackenzie Holmes and Serena Sundell, as well as Breanna Frazier were the last three players left in training camp. Not a huge surprise. Cook was the first
Delay
player
Daniels.
off the bench waived by the Lynx. No, never probably really had a shot. Their roster is very deep. Cook was the first player off the bench in their preseason game. Looked like she played a lot in that scrimmage against the Sparks, from what we could tell. So this was not terribly surprising, even if the Storm's needs, like coming into training camp, it seemed like, a combo guard like Zaya Cook is, was much more important to them than it seems now with Katie Lou Samuelson's injury.
How many years are we away from a WNBA G League?
Still a long period of time.
15 years?
I mean,
They have to get to basically like a full host of teams before that.
I guess that's plausible. I often think that the WNBA right now is where the NBA is in the 1980s, and the NBA G League in its original D League form came in like 2002, 2003, somewhere in there. So, that would be within 20 years. Other questions?
No, that was I just want to talk about the season in general.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
So, I didn't know if you want to talk about what the plans are. but I guess going into the season overall, WNBA wise, who are the favorites if you had to pick three teams or something like that? And where are the Fever at in that conversation? I guess also where are the Wings?
So, as I tier this out, and I'll post my projections on Blue Sky before opening night. To me, New York, Vegas, and Minnesota are the clear top three teams, and you can debate which order. I think New York has to be considered still the favorite coming off the championship. But, Minnesota did have a nice offseason. They added Carly Samuelson, Katie Lou's sister, to upgrade their bench shooting. They added Jessica Shepherd back to their roster. So, I like what Minnesota's done. And then Vegas, gets Jewell Loyd. It'll be interesting to see how she fits in. I think that will go better than last season in Seattle did for her in terms of her sort of
I'm
understanding where
real
she
skeptical
fits
about Vegas.
in the Aces
Very
pecking
skeptical.
order. They added Cheyenne Parker-Tyus. She's currently pregnant, but should be back by the playoffs and would be the most talented post player they've had alongside Asia Wilson since Candace Parker was healthy and they were dominant in the first half of 2023. So I think any of those three teams could realistically win the championship. I think Indiana is probably in a tier of its own in fourth, I would say, in the
Interesting.
WNBA. My projections like Atlanta quite a bit, but Indiana was already coming on in the second half of last season and added Dawana Bonner, Natasha Howard, Sophie Cunningham. They've really strengthened, their front court alongside Leah Boston. And these are players who should, I think, fit quite well with Caitlin Clark. So, I think that winning a playoff series is the expectation for the Fever. And, you get them in the semifinals and maybe they make some noise there.
What about the Wings?
Wings, I would put in a group with Atlanta, Seattle, and Phoenix, I think are the next four teams in my mind. Dallas
Really?
might be more in the group with Chicago and LA that's fighting for the eighth
Is
spot.
that just because of Paige Bekkers, or
I
what
would
is
also
your
add in,
expectation for Paige Bekkers?
we don't rank rookies in our top 25. I would not have had her. I think she was kind of on the borderline of that somewhere. I think she finished like 27th in her hoop stats, ranking the WNBA project, and that seemed about fair to me. So, she's going to be a major upgrade for them at a position of weakness. Like, that's not so different from the level that Skylar Diggins played at over the course of all of last season. And you saw what a huge upgrade she was. And then they added Dejanay Carrington, who I think is going to be like, Dallas was actually pretty good offensively last year. They just, better than the Storm, they just couldn't stop anyone. And Dejanay Carrington is undoubtedly going to help that.
And then I guess Kelsey Plum and the Sparks. You mentioned they're in the tier with the Storm.
No, they're in the tier with Chicago and possibly Dallas. And I think
Okay.
the Sparks are a bit overrated coming into this season. They
Really?
still have, some questions, I think, at point guard with Julie Alamand injured at the start of the season. Cameron Brink's not going to be back until mid-June. So, she'll miss probably the first quarter of the season. It looks like coming back from her ACL injury. I think they are less likely to make, they are more likely to miss the playoffs than to make them, which obviously is a big deal for the
I
Storm,
was
who
going to
hold
say,
their
so it's
2026 first round pick.
cheering for the Storm to win games. Who are we cheering against? Is it specifically just the Sparks or?
Well, they also have Vegas's first round pick. Now that one doesn't have as much upside. I would say the other thing you are like hoping for is that therefore the Golden State is really competitive right away, and that therefore LA's 2-year record might potentially be behind them in going into the lottery
Is there a
standings.
chance of that happening?
It's a long shot, but I think the Valkyries can be competitive. They won both of their pre or they won their one of their preseason games and lost the other at the buzzer to LA.
So the Storm basically this offseason, obviously the Jewell Loyd trade happened. It is one of those things that maybe culture-wise, like the if it wasn't great for an entire year, if Jewell Loyd wasn't happy for an entire season, that could have derailed. They might have been a 10,
Well, I would say it was
15% better team.
whatever happened seems to mostly have manifested itself after the Olympic break when they kind of fell off considerably.
Probably a little bit of a rebuild. Obviously, they got younger. They traded Jewell Loyd. They ended up with Malanga.
Well, sort of. They also got a bit older. They brought in Alicia Clark and Erica Wheeler. Alicia Clark is now, with Diana Taurasi's retirement, the oldest player in the WNBA, which is wild given, how long it took her to establish herself in the league. So there's, the two timelines thing is kind of a joke because of the Warriors, but there is sort of a two timelines thing with the Storm where those free agent signings, as we talked about,
Ezzie and Malanga are the next timeline.
correct. And then the 2026 picks. And Jordan Horstin, who we should mention, I didn't put this in the notes, but the Storm announced today they picked up her 4th-year rookie option. It was a little bit of a borderline decision because of her injury. She would not have been a free agent had they declined that. She would have only been able to negotiate with them. So that would have been a scenario. This does guarantee her contract for 2026, but basically, because of the way that the salary cap is going to go up, she's going to be making the minimum next year. And
Okay.
she's an important part of the future. So, I think certainly a reasonable decision. So Horstin's in that group, I would say, too. But yeah, what signing Alicia Clark allowed you to do is not have to draft for need at number two and to get to take Dominique Malanga. And I think that was absolutely the right strategy.
Okay, then I guess last two questions before we move on. Are do you think the Storm are a playoff team?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, there's probably about 75%. I can see what the ESPN bet is on that one because that is one of their wagers. But I think much more likely than not.
And then, how much of an impact do you think Malanga will have this season?
I am trying to keep things realistic, I would say. Look, she's one of the youngest players in the league. I haven't looked at it. I'm not sure how many, if anyone, is younger. I don't know if we also have full birth dates yet, but she's one of the youngest players in the league. She's also in a position the Storm are deep at. Like, They have Azzi Magbegor. The two of them can play together as well, I think. But and then Lee is going to be important for them in certain matchups with her ability to defend the post. So, I mean, she's not going to come out and play 25 minutes a night right away. But I think that's a good thing long term. The Storm are going to be able to ease into her into it. And when she is playing well, you can extend those minutes and take advantage of it. And when she doesn't play well, it's not going to be that costly. Yeah, they're minus 600 to make the playoffs. So pretty overwhelming favorites.
Okay. What are the Sparks?
The Sparks are minus 160. And I would have them more in Dallas is only minus 115, basically even odds. So I think Dallas is better than Los Angeles pretty clearly and
Okay.
maybe pretty comfortably.
All right. Well, Saturday night, is that on TV?
Yeah, that'll be on Como 4.
Oh, wow.
As many of
Okay.
the games this season will be.
Really?
Yeah.
We probably talked about this.
We did, although I'm not sure I had a full count then. So yeah, the Saturday night at Phoenix, then Monday they will be in Dallas to take on Paige Bueckers in the Wings battle of the number one and number two picks. Not that they will necessarily square off individually. That one will be on CW Seattle, not on Como, but many of the games will be on Como this season. And then a 3-day break before they head home, and then we'll begin their home schedule. All right, UW news. First, a little bit from the men's basketball side. No surprise here. Quincy Pondexter returning to UW as, quote, special assistant to the head coach. Not assistant regional manager, assistant to the regional manager. This is a situation where basically Huskies wanted to get Quincy Pondexter back, did not want to let go of any of their assistant coaches from last year. So kind of slotting him into the coaching staff this way.
He's also special assistant to being related to Wesley Yates.
But also someone who merits being an assistant coach in his own rights
He'll
based on
be on the
his
coaching
career.
staff in a year.
Yeah. Our UW softball lost their Big Ten tournament opener 2-0 to Indiana, managing just two hits off Hoosier starter Brianna Copeland, who went the distance. They loaded the bases with nobody out in the bottom of the sixth, but had a line-out double play followed by a strikeout to end the rally. Truly Mariners-esque. It's almost if you had told me that Mitch Garver grounded it, lined out into the double play, I would believe it. And then went 1-2-3 in the bottom of the seventh as their first Big Ten tournament ended quickly. But still, they were selected for their 31st consecutive NCAA tournament as part of the Texas Tech Regional. They will face Mississippi State on Friday on ESPN2 in their opening game. Brown, the fourth team in the double elimination regional. The host Red Raiders were ranked only number 18 in RPI, but Mississippi State, a very strong one of the top non-seeded teams at number 22, having gone 13 and 11 in the deep SEC. The Ivy League champion Brown ranks 121st in
Yeah,
RPI.
nerds. So one team is going to come out of this group.
Correct.
What is the structure of the bracket look like? Everybody plays everybody else?
Huskies play Mississippi State on Friday. Winner of that plays presumably Texas Tech, the winner of the first game. And then the loser of that then goes into an elimination game. So that's a scenario that Huskies could find themselves in facing Brown in an elimination game on Saturday. Then you'd have to win that and beat the team that loses the battle of the two winning teams on Saturday to get to Sunday, where if you lose, you have to beat the team that is undefeated twice on
It ends, it's
Sunday.
kind of fun how it's structured.
Yeah. So if they lose Friday, it's not the end of the tournament, but it makes the road a lot tougher, much more plausible for them to advance if they win on Friday night. Baseball was swept in their series at number five, Oregon. They lost the opener 5-0, next two games
I mean,
by
they
two
didn't
runs
do it for the
each.
rundown.
I mean, they've proven themselves rundown worthy.
Ugh.
They don't need to do it for the rundown every series. They're
Rundown worthy.
still tied for it's like Spongeworthy. Still
Yeah.
tied for fifth in the Big Ten standings ahead of hosting USC in the final weekend of the regular season. They could pass the Trojans, but that would require sweeping them. USC dropped out of the top 25 after losing two of three at home to Michigan State last weekend. All right, we wrap up with a little Seahawks news as we await the schedule release on Wednesday. Eagerly await the schedule release on Wednesday. Adam Schefter reported the Seahawks have signed Gray Zabel to his rookie contract. That's Then one of the things worth watching, they also signed all seven of their picks from day three of the draft, have not yet signed their day two picks. And worth watching, the first two picks of the second round ahead of Nick Amendwario and both signed fully guaranteed contracts, setting a new precedent for second rounders. Seems likely that he will probably follow suit, given that.
That's fine.
And then the Seahawks hosted eight-year veteran cornerback Rasul Douglas for a visit per Tom Pelissero of the NFL Network. Another option for them is the long-rumored signing of Shaquille Griffin. His return to Seattle has yet to come to pass. So we will monitor that situation.
Yeah, we'll be heavily monitoring the Rasul Douglas situation this May.
All eyes. On a lonely nation turns its eyes to you, Rasul Douglas. All right.
We made it in time.
I told you I wanted to be done by 11:30, and indeed we were. It was speedy. Next week will be more ponderous as we get to the conclusion of Andor.
Okay, fair enough. I love that that's the thing we're covering now. Rasul Douglas, Andor, Husky baseball.
I mean...
See you next week.
We had a whole section on bowlers on HBO. I think we can talk about Andor. We did a segment on a live podcast about after bowlers.
Wow. I'm so sad that we don't do that anymore.
Bring it back. Bring it back. I also wanted to say get well soon to Mrs. Fantasy Genius. So.
That sounds like she's fallen ill.
She suffered
BMX accident.
An injury that we are familiar with from pro sports, a meniscus tear.
It a made me think possible of, meniscus
oh,
tear.
Oh, she hasn't been fully diagnosed. You remember the story about...
I explained to her that Jason Tatum tore his Achilles and already had surgery.
It's true. They moved quickly on them.
And the doctors just, I don't know, maybe her name was lost in the queue, but they didn't get to her fast enough.
I don't know if you remember, friend of the pod, Black Trey from the BOMM podcast, loved to share the story of, so is a high level basketball player. His knees had taken a bit of a pounding over time, and he tore his meniscus while teaching.
Oh my God.
He just like planted funny and then like had to whisper to the student teacher, like, I just tore my meniscus. I gotta go.
He knew that he tore his meniscus.
He knew.
He's like, ah, meniscus tear. That's, I guess, you know, he's in tune with his body, I suppose.
If you know, but you know.
We'll see. It might not even be a torn meniscus.
Okay, possible meniscus
tear. A possible meniscus tear.
You either just way.
Get well soon as if it's... She's taken ill from a BMX accident.
Lassie, come quick. There's been a BMX accident.
It was also her first time on the gate of BMX. Oh, wow. And I was like, don't tell anybody that. I was like, just tell people. Of course, this podcast, it's just between us guys, okay? I was like, just say that you were BMX racing. Give no further context.
It is a pretty cool way to injure your meniscus, all things considered.
It's cooler than teaching. Wait, sorry. Teaching's cool, y'all.
Getting injured while teaching is not, alas, not
teaching's very cool.
Yeah. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.